is CBS Eye on the World. Here's John Batchelor.
The world economy, the U.S. economy, they are related in terms of inflation, recovering from the pandemic, supply chain, perhaps, spending, perhaps. However, we go to London now to ask the same questions about inflation and its ally or enemy, growth, depending upon the school that you follow. I follow Joe Sternberg's school. He writes political economics for the Wall Street Journal. And recently, he did us all the favor of reviewing the 49 days of Liz Truss's premiership and what lessons learned and questions to be answered in future about the program that Ms. Truss and her Chancellor of the Exchequer, Mr. Kartung, brought forward that was rejected, appeared to be rejected in the headlines. And what do we learn about the United Kingdom's ambition for growing or for the status quo ante? Joe, a very good evening to you. 49 days, Liz Truss. And as I remember, the headlines were so alarming at the end, the Bank of England was on fire. What do we now review in our temperate moods of the 49 days? How did she propose something that was so irregular that even the Tories, who were still in command of the economy, panicked? Good evening to you.
Hey, John. Well, this is back in the news. It's certainly a story that I think that many people in Britain would prefer to forget at this point. But it crashed back into the headlines over the past week because Liz Truss herself has reemerged into the political fray. She had been keeping a very low profile after she left office back in October. And, now suddenly has come out with a big 4,000-word essay in a prominent national newspaper in the UK. And then she also sat down for an interview with a prominent political magazine where she is starting to offer her explanation of what went wrong during her tenure. And this is triggering new debate about that. And so her broad statement of her case is that she and her Chancellor Kwasi Kwarteng understood that Britain had been trapped in this low interest rate, low inflation world, low economic growth world for a very long time. This had triggered a bunch of policy decisions over many years to do with ramping up government spending and borrowing because interest rates were very low. This also then meant that productivity growth was very low, and this would not be sustainable now that inflation was coming back and interest rates had to rise. So I think the first thing that she said has been pretty controversial, although she isn't always very articulate as a saleswoman for her own policies, which is a big part of her political problem. But she has created a bit of controversy by suggesting that actually her policies were intended to be a response to this specific economic circumstance, which I think turns out to be a correct diagnosis of what's been happening. And then from that, she goes on to say that a big part of her problem was that she had to spend a lot of borrowed money through the government on energy subsidies, because a big part of the economic problem was the legacy of many decades of bad energy policies and environmental policies that had pushed up household and business prices for electricity and natural gas. So that is the second thing that she said that I think is sort of riling people the wrong way, because to admit that she was correct about that, you would have to admit that all of these policies have been wrong for decades. And then the third part of her argument has been that, and this has by far been the most controversial thing that she says, that there exists an anti-growth coalition out there of forces that conspired to thwart her policies. And she never entirely suggests that this is actually a conspiracy in the sense that people would pick up the phone and call each other and then coordinate their moves to obstruct her. My read is that what she's getting at is that there are a bunch of interest groups that had developed that were profiting from the old economic order and are not really ready for the kind of disruption that her policies would have brought. And that actually does seem like a plausible argument. But the problem with all of this is that a lot of people have looked at it as a form of Monday morning quarterbacking now that, she's out of office and it was a miserable failure. And people are interpreting this as just sort of another failed attempt at self-justification, rather than what I think it actually is, which is a pretty serious argument about what is going on in the British economy right now and what can or should be done about it.
It was the Tory approval of Liz Truss to be prime minister and the Tory rejection of Liz Truss that led to her downfall. So this party, what did they see to both bring her into office and to get rid of her? Do we have a short version?
Well, I think one of the political embarrassments here has been that that dynamic that you just described has exposed a huge gap between the membership of the Conservative or Tory party out in the countryside and the Tory politicians here in London, because Liz Truss was the first choice for prime minister of the actual members of the party out in the grassroots, who seemed to have found her economic message very appealing. And the specific thing that they found appealing was this idea that actually growth is a desirable and an achievable goal for the British economy, and that it's something that politicians realistically should be working toward. And the Tory elected politicians seem to have lost that faith. I think that they tend to view the slow growth of the past decade as an input into the political process rather than an output of it, which means that rather than thinking of slow growth as a consequence of the policy and political decisions that they have made, they want to view it as a given. And so then your political challenge becomes redistributing whatever spoils are left from the slowing economy. And she was really trying to shake that up. And what her, her meteoric rise and then very rapid fall exposed is this big gaping political gap between where the grassroots stands on a bunch of these issues and where the elected leadership of the party stands.
She writes in her column, "Stop apologizing for our Tory beliefs and to be positive and optimistic about our country's future resonated with our members and voters." That's how she got herself elected by the party. And then suddenly she says that the direction of the party is higher tax, higher spend, and choked by ever more regulation. I didn't know that's what the Tory party represented, at least to some of the people in the Tory party. That's indistinguishable from the Labour party, I think, Joe. Now, it's impossible to read from this distance. I don't want to project onto the parliament politics that suit the Congress. You know, one party is associated with regulation and higher taxes, and the other one is associated with deregulation and low taxes. Is that the same in Britain, or is there that faction within the Tory party the fighting it out?
Well, it's interesting because I think that what has happened here since the Thatcher era in the 1980s in some ways mirrors what seems to have happened in U.S. politics since the Reagan era of the 80s. So in both instances, you had politicians inheriting a badly stagnating, very demoralized economy and country, turning it around with the big bang of economic reforms and tax cuts and a new emphasis on the private sector. And then you went through a phase where the party of the left, whether it was the Democrats in America or Britain's Labour Party, kind of tried to adopt portions of that conservative program as their own. And that this was the era of Bill Clinton's third way or New Labour here in the UK, which were going to try to basically accept a lot of those free market policies from the conservative side, but just put a bit of a more social democratic spin on it with a friendlier face and more benefits. And then, now we've had this legacy of conservative parties in their turn trying to co-opt the left-wing party's co-option of the earlier conservative parties. And so, this would create a Tory party in the UK that would try to come in, that came into power in 2010, arguing that they were not fundamentally going to dismantle any of the new look, third way welfare state that the Blairite Labour Party had created, but the Tories would somehow manage it more competently, and they would kind of get the budget under control and achieve economic growth that way. But the Conservatives had definitely lost that original liberalizing or reforming zeal that they had. And so I think that what is fascinating about the Liz Truss situation is that her political rise suggested that actually there is a large segment of the grassroots of the party, the actual electorate, that still wants that original free market liberalizing vision from the Thatcher era. And yet they are being thwarted by a political cast at the top of the Conservative Party that thinks that what they have to do to keep winning elections is to continue with this very woolly form of, not really conservative conservatism. And so that tension is the thing that keeps bubbling up here.
Joseph Sternberg, member of the editorial board of the Wall Street Journal. He's based in London. He writes political economics. In London, these last days, we've seen the war in Europe come into Parliament, come into the premiership itself, when Rishi Sunak has devoted much attention to the visiting President Zelensky. Is that a matter of concern, however, because the politics of the United Kingdom right now suggest there's another former prime minister devoted to Mr. Zelensky, and that his name is Boris Johnson. So when we come back, competition for the lead Ukraine booster in the Conservative Party. I'm John Batchelor.
Take a look under your bed. Find stuff under there? What about jobs? No? Now try your basement. There's a pair of overalls that overall you're not so into anymore. A perfectly good laptop that hasn't sat in your lap in months. And even more stuff, but still no jobs? Well, you really have both. See, stuff is defined as household articles considered as a group. Sometimes this stuff is no longer needed. Wait, no longer needed? That can't be right. Because remember those jobs you were looking for? Those are really needed, and they're the stuff inside your stuff. Even inside that winter coat that moved with you to Phoenix. Our job is to unlock those jobs, and it starts when you donate your stuff to your local Goodwill. Here's how we do it. When you donate to Goodwill, we sell your stuff to provide job training for people right here in your community. So just by teaming up with Goodwill, you help create jobs. And isn't that worth parting with the leftover keytar from your 80s cover band? Goodwill. Donate stuff, create jobs. Find your nearest donation center at goodwill.org. A message from Goodwill and the Ad Council.
The sun's shining, birds are singing, and all feels right in the world.
Until the season changes, and suddenly everything seems darker, less lively, and you lose your motivation to get out of bed.
If you struggle with depression, you're not alone. In fact, 1 in 5 people experience some form of depression, and no matter the time of year, it may affect your behavioral or physical ability to live a happy life.
At the American Psychiatric Association Foundation, we understand what you're going through, and we're here to help. Our vision is to build a mentally healthy nation for all, because we want you to live your best life and be your best you all year round. We work every day to eliminate stigma, combat mental illness and substance use disorders, and advance mental wellness.
If you or someone you love needs help, you are not alone. Please visit mentallyhealthynation.org to learn more.